Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is January 17th, 2026, and I'm your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Don't You Want Me? Etomidate or Ketamine for Induction of Critically Ill Patients? And our guest skeptic, I know he doesn't need any introduction, but if I say his name correctly, we don't even need to go on with the introduction. Weingart here. Yes, that's right. It is the man, the myth, the legend, Dr. Scott Weingart. He's an ED intensivist from New York City. He did his fellowship in trauma, surgical critical care, and ECMO. Scott is best known for talking to himself. I hope you're not answering yourself. That's a sign of something. But he's known to talk to himself about resuscitation and critical care on a podcast called MCRIT, which has been downloaded apparently more than 50 million times. Welcome back to the SGEM, Scott.
Always a pleasure, Ken. So happy to be speaking, particularly about this topic, one that I truly love.
Yeah, it's an epic topic. And you picked an epic 80s song by Human League, Don't You Want Me? What a great song. I wouldn't have thought of that for this episode. So excellent contribution already to the critical appraisal process.
Well, you know, it's my buddy Ketamine that's saying that in vain of that song.
Don't you want me? Don't you want me, Ketamine?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, we haven't seen each other for a while. We're getting together virtually, but I am really looking forward to 2026 because in April, we are going to meet up again in Murcia. I've got to say it like that. Murcia, Spain at Incrementum 2026. Are you excited too?
I'm beyond excited. You know, I was excited for the first round, and I think you were too, but we didn't quite know what we were getting. Everything leading up to it told us this is going to be extraordinary because they were so on the ball and everything. And it just lived up to those expectations and then exceeded them. And now knowing what we're going to get, which is, you know, that baseline of number one now taken to 11 for number two, I can't imagine a conference that I am more excited about to attend in 2026. This is going to be the conference of the year. I have that same enthusiasm I have for all of the greatest conferences I have ever attended because basically for emergency medicine, this is it. I can't imagine a conference doing better than this. Ken, what would you add to that hyperbole I've just spewed out there?
The hyperbole, first of all, I recognize the Rob Reiner reference of this goes to 11. So that was very kind of you after he had that unfortunate tragedy recently. So yes, this conference will go to 11, even though it's the second conference they've ever done. If we're talking hyperbole and allegories and stuff like that, I would refer to this like Star Wars. And it wasn't called Star Wars Episode 4, you know, A New Hope. It was just called Star Wars. We didn't know what we were getting, but oh my God, were we blown away. And you think, they can't possibly replicate that. They can't possibly do better. And yet Empire Strikes Back, Episode 5, arguably the best Star Wars movie. And Carmen and Paco have put together this group, this enthusiastic group of really talented, and I'm looking for the right phrase, the French kiss of emergency medicine speakers. Oh, it'll be so good. Evidence given in digestible chunks that you can process and then bring back to your own shop. And look at the location, Spain. Spain, I have never eaten my weight in paella until I went to Spain. Epic food, epic people, epic location. Oh, and by the way, it's a great educational experience.
Yeah, but that's secondary to all the stuff.
Yeah.
Now, there were two problematic analogies you made there, Ken.
Okay, yeah.
And so one, completely agree, Empire, absolutely the best Star Wars movie. But the problem is you've now doomed them, if we keep with that analogy, for number three being a true disappointment compared to the other two. So hopefully they will keep the mold for that second one and then break the mold for Return of the Jedi because they could do better than that movie in the trilogy.
You know, I could have used Star Trek, but the motion picture, the original, you know, in 1979, it was called the slow motion picture. It really didn't get the love it deserved. It was an epic opera, an homage to the original, but it was an indulgent a bit too much. And that's not what Incrementum was. Incrementum was just, they hit it out of the park on number one. But of course, Star Trek number two, Khan, was the best one. But we're not here to talk about that, are we?
No. Well, the second analogy may be more pertinent, which is you compared it to a French kiss. Now, you made the hand gestures of a chef's kiss, but maybe the French kiss is more apt. Maybe is a French kiss to the rest of the conference attendees. And if it is, well, then it'll be even exceeding my expectations on another level.
Yeah, I'm not. Clearly I misspoke. And maybe it's the Canadian in me that we have French and English Canada. So a chef's kiss usually refers to French Canadian because they are amazing when it comes to cooking, not so much in the rest of Canada. But I don't want to lose listeners here. So let's get on with a case there.
Yes, but go to Incrementum is what we want you to understand.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you can go to incrementum-conference.com. Hey, if you're listening to this, pause. Go to your browser, go to your cell phone, go to whatever device you have and sign up today. All right, Scott, I don't know if you know this, but this is episode number 500 for the SGM. This is special. This is sort of like, wow, I can't believe in 2011 when I was thinking about doing a podcast, 2012 after I went to Oxford to do a little mini fellowship course on knowledge translation of evidence-based medicine. I didn't think I'd be sitting here in 2026 talking to the Weingart on the 500th episode of a critical appraisal of a recent publication.
Ken, well, first of all, congratulations. That is a huge achievement. And I'm really honored to be on episode number 500. So thank you.
I looked back today. And so there's 500 critical appraisals and 125 SGEM extras where I delve into some more of philosophical things of an approach to medicine or what did I learn from, you know, Batman or Star Trek or some of those types of things. So 625 in all, but this is the 500 critical appraisal. And it's my honor to have you here because you know more about critical care than I do. I'm the nerd. I can look at the stats and talk about, did they do a per protocol analysis when they did it, or was it an intention to treat analysis, those types of things. But boy, do you have clinical experience that far exceeds mine when it comes to critically ill patients. And that's what we need. We need a blend of both. We need the nerds to come together with the pragmatic people who have that clinical experience to say, this actually doesn't work when you try to apply it, or this can work. We just don't have evidence that it works, Ken, which isn't evidence that it doesn't work. Those are two different concepts. So it works in my hands. Great. Do I have proof that it works? Some objective outside source? No, but that doesn't mean it doesn't work. And so I think it's really important that people experience that nuance between those two perspectives.
Could not agree more.
All right, let's get on to a case. Give us a case for this that we're going to be talking about, etomidate and ketamine.
Sure. So you're working in an evening shift in a busy tertiary care emergency department. EMS rolls in with a 62-year-old woman with a history of hypertension and type 2 diabetes. She's febrile, 39.2. Tachycardic at 125 beats per minute, hypotensive at 86 over 52. She's gotten 2 liters of fluid, and she's breathing at 32 on a non-rebreather with an oxygen sat of 88%. The chest x-ray shows a right lower lobe infiltrate. Her lactate is a whopping 5.6. She's now on a norepi drip at 0.15 micrograms per kilogram per minute and still not looking that great. She's exhausted, she's altered, and you decide it is time to pull the trigger on intubating. Now, you decide on an RSI, a rapid sequence intubation, and this is hopefully going to ameliorate her work of breathing and her impending respiratory failure. The respiratory therapist is at the bedside, and the pharmacist has arrived with the RSI med box. And your resident says, for induction, we should go with ketamine because she's septic and hypotensive. Or actually, should we go with etomidate because we're worried about pushing her over at the edge? What should we do?
What should we do? Way to set up the case. And, you know, I loved hearing to it, you know, because clearly it's a tertiary care center. What is this RT you talk of? And who is this pharmacist with this magical box? You know, I'm in a critical access hospital. It's myself, two nurses, and maybe the registration clerk, maybe the janitor has to come in, stuff like that. But wow, talk about resources. Love it. The RT's there and you've got a resuscitation box. oh, how cool. And you also painted a picture of a very critically ill patient. We are not talking about a soft call here. I mean, a lactate of almost 6, despite really good resuscitation, she's still hypotensive. She's still hypoxic. She's tachycardic. She's tachypneic. This is a critically ill patient. And this is what we're talking about today. And intubating critically ill patients, it's one of those high stake, high adrenaline things that we do. Yes. Welcome to our place in emergency medicine. But you know, the physiology, it's stacked up against us right from the beginning. These patients come in like this one. They're hypoxic. They're hypotensive. They're acidotic. They're catecholamine depleted even before we reach for that laryngoscope. And when you look at emergency airway registries and multicenter cohort studies, they consistently report peri-intubation complications. And when I'm talking about complications, I'm talking about these people crash. They have profound hypotension, get really hypoxic, cardiac arrest, death, failed or difficult intubation. And we see this in 1 out of 10, 2 out of 10 of critically ill adult intubated patients in the ED or the intensive care unit. And even a single episode of severe hypotension or hypoxemia during intubation, it's associated, because obviously we're not randomizing these people, but it's associated with increased mortality. So really important stuff. And then you look at it as organ failure, and this is in the ICU population. So you know what? That choice that you laid out of the induction agent, it matters.
Oh, absolutely. Etomidate became the darling of emergency RSI when I was first training, you know, a few decades ago, because of its rapid onset, short duration, and relatively preserved hemodynamics compared with agents we were using historically, like thiopental or high-dose propofol. The flip side was the adrenal suppression. A single dose transiently inhibits 11-beta hydroxylase and measurably blunts cortisol production for 24 to 72 hours. Now, observational studies and post-hoc analyses in septic shock raised alarms that etomidate might increase mortality by worsening relative adrenal insufficiency, leading some guidelines and regulators to discourage or even remove etomidate in sepsis or across the board in countrywide decisions made. But those were mostly in non-randomized data, and prior RCTs comparing etomidate with other agents were small and gave conflicting signals about mortality.
Yeah, talk about overinterpreting the literature and over-applying the literature into these blanket statements of thou shalt not, thou must not use, based on very low-level evidence. But let's look at ketamine in contrast. It's a dissociative agent. It's an NMDA antagonist with a real different vibe. Oh yeah, it's even got a cool nickname, right? Special K. And it provides profound amnesia and analgesia, and it maintains airway reflexes to some degree and has sympathomimetic properties that can increase the heart rate and blood pressure by catecholamine releases. Those properties have made ketamine a very attractive agent in shock patients where we're worried that propofol or midazolam will just tank the pressure, right? We'll just drop that blood pressure profoundly. However, in catecholamine-depleted shock patients, and this is an important nuance, ketamine direct myocardial hemodynamic advantage over etomidate is not as clear as many of us, you and I remember being taught, oh yeah, no, ketamine preserves that. Yeah, no, you don't have to worry about the blood pressure. Oh, I think you should still be worried. Old concerns that ketamine raises intracranial pressure, however, have largely been debunked in modern neurocritical care literature, further widening our appeal for, hey, I think I'm going to choose ketamine in this case.
Now, other agents, I guess, are still in the mix, though not commonly used in the ED. Propofol remains widely used in operating room practice and some EDs because of its familiarity and ease of titration, but it predictably causes vasodilation and negative inotropy in its elective operation dose range, making it a frequent offender in peri-intubation hypotension amongst critically ill patients. Benzos, for instance, midazolam, have a slower onset, more variable effect, and a longer half-life. And when used as a primary induction agent in shock, they've been associated with more hypotension compared with etomidate or ketamine. Fentanyl and other opioids are often later on for analgesia or blunting the sympathetic surge, but they could also precipitate abrupt hypotension and apnea in already fragile patients.
So Scott, for years, like years, almost a decade, we've been stuck between this theoretical, oh my goodness, adrenal toxicity of etomidate, and the hoped for hemodynamic benefits of ketamine. But we didn't have a large, definitive randomized control trial in the emergency department or intensive care unit setting in patients powered for that patient-oriented outcome, the poo that we like mortality. But now we do. So what's the clinical question?
In critically ill adults undergoing emergency tracheal intubation in the ED or ICU, which induction agent is better, ketamine or etomidate?
Ketamine or etomidate. And what's the reference?
This is Casey et al. For the RSI Investigators and the Pragmatic Critical Care Research Group. Ketamine or etomidate for tracheal intubation of critically ill adults, the New England Journal of Medicine, 2025.
Let's run through the PCOT. What was the population?
Critically ill adults greater or equal to 18 years of age, undergoing or plan to undergo tracheal intubation in an ED or ICU, where the treating clinician intended to use either ketamine or etomidate for induction, conducted at 6 emergency departments and 8 ICUs in the U.S.
And they excluded a number of different patient populations, some of the usual suspects, if they could be pregnant or suspected to be pregnant, prisoners. They didn't include trauma patients, and these weren't children. And so I'll put a list of the exclusion criteria in the show notes, and we'll probably talk about this as a limitation later on. What was the intervention?
So the ketamine group received one of three dose ranges of ketamine, 1, 1.5, or 2 milligrams per kilogram of ketamine given immediately before intubation. Treating clinicians chose neuromuscular blocking agents, pre- and post-intubation vasopressors, fluids, and other medications according to local practice in a pragmatic fashion.
Yeah, so they were assigned, randomized into the ketamine group, but then everything else after that was left up to the clinician and local practices. And their comparison group was?
The etomidate group got 0.2, 0.25, or 0.3 milligrams per kilogram of etomidate at the clinician's discretion. And again, all other aspects of airway management and resuscitation were left to the clinician's judgment.
All right, and then they had a number of outcomes, but what was their primary outcome of interest?
In-hospital death by day 28 after randomization.
So very objective, right? Hard to not get that concrete. Yeah, alive or dead within the month. And then they had a number of secondary outcomes. They had a composite outcome of cardiovascular collapse during the interval between when you gave the induction agent and then 2 minutes after tracheal intubation. And that composite was defined as if their systolic blood pressure dropped below 65 millimeters of mercury, or you had to start a new vasopressor, or an increase in the vasopressor dose that you were already using a vasopressor, or cardiac arrest. That was the composite outcome. And then there were some exploratory outcomes we're not going to get into. All right, what type of study was this?
It was a therapeutic parallel group multicenter randomized control trial.
All right, and the author's conclusions were, quote, among critically ill adults undergoing tracheal intubation, the use of ketamine to induce anesthesia did not result in a significantly lower incidence of in-hospital death by day 28 than etomidate. All right, let's run through the quality checklist quickly here for RCTs. Are these ED patients that we're worried about?
Yes, about 56% of the patients got their intubations in the emergency department and then 44% in the ICU. And this was spread across 6 U.S. academic EDs and 8 of the ICUs.
Yeah, so one of our concerns with some of these critically ill patient studies is that most of the clinical care took place in the ICU for the thing that we were looking at. And the majority, 56%, actually happened in the ED. So that was really good. Do you think that the patients were adequately randomized?
Yes. A computer-generated random sequence with variable block sizes was used and stratified by site.
And this randomization process that you just mentioned, did they conceal the process from the people involved in the study?
Yes, they did. Allocation was implemented via sequentially numbered, opaque, sealed envelopes at each site.
And were the patients analyzed in the groups to which they were randomized?
Yes. The primary analysis followed the intention to treat principle, including all randomized patients except a tiny number who withdrew before outcome ascertainment, and they performed sensitivity analyses for those missing patients.
Yeah, so technically it was a modified ITT, but really, I mean, you know, when you looked at the numbers, it was an itty bitty number that, you know, weren't included in the intention to treat. And then they did what's called a sensitivity analysis to make sure that it didn't bias the result. Were the patients included, were they recruited consecutively?
It's unsure based on what was written in the paper. The paper describes enrolling eligible adults undergoing intubation, but does not explicitly state that consecutive eligible patients were enrolled or provide a screening log. Speaking with the authors, the answer is probably.
Probably, yeah. Were both groups similar with respect to prognostic factors, like coming into it?
Yes, baseline age, sex, race, comorbidities, sepsis, Apache 2 scores, pre-intubation vitals, and vasopressor use were very similar between groups. The differences were small and clinically trivial.
Yeah, and this shows the fidelity of the randomization process then. Were all participants blinded?
No, and this is a particular sticking point when we come to the discussion of this. This was an open-label trial. Clinicians and research staff knew the assigned agent.
And were all the groups treated equally except for ketamine for you, etomidate for you?
Well, as a pragmatic trial, the answers were unsure because beyond the induction drug, all the other aspects of care, fluid, vasopressors, neuromuscular blockade, peri-intubation sedation, steroids, et cetera, were left to clinician discretion and not standardized or reported, though a lot of them were actually reported in the supplements of the trial.
Yeah, sometimes you have to go to the supplements to get those pieces of data. How about the follow-up? Did they capture almost everybody?
Yes, for the primary outcome, which was in-hospital death by day 28, only six of 2,365 patients, that's 0.3%, withdrew before day 28. So that was three in each group.
Yeah, so a tiny number. Do you think that all patient important outcomes were considered?
Yes, they measured short-term in-hospital death by day 28. That was the primary outcome. They measured cardiovascular collapse during intubation, ventilator and vasopressor and ICU-free days, longer-term mortality all the way out to 3 and 12 months. And while quality of life wasn't captured, the major outcomes we and our patients care about were well represented in this study.
Was the treatment effect large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
Well, no, but in the sense that there really was no important difference seen. The primary outcome risk difference was minus 0.8 percentage points with a 95% confidence interval of negative 4.5 to positive 2.9. which is small, it crosses zero, and while it excludes a large mortality difference, it doesn't show a clinically important benefit of ketamine or etomidate.
Yeah, I hope people were listening carefully to that last part of the sentence because it didn't show a large mortality benefit, but we can't rule out a smaller clinically important benefit, and we'll get into that. Hey, where'd the money come from, Scott?
So the trial was funded by the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, that's PCORI, the U.S. National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, and the U.S. Department of Defense, among others. But the funders had no role in study design, conduct, analysis, or manuscript preparation, and none of these funding groups were pharma or anyone else that you'd be really scared about.
And what about the authors? Did they have any conflicts of interest to declare?
Yes. Now, several authors reported research funding and consulting fees from various organizations like the NIH, the Department of Defense, which, Ken, I don't know about you. That doesn't bother me so much. I don't even consider those conflicts. There were a few with Octa Pharma and other companies, but none of these had anything to do with the manufacture or utilization of ketamine or etomidate.
Yeah. And importantly, I mean, this is the last point of the checklist, but some people interpret sort of the declaring of conflicts of interest as some form of ad hominem attack. It is not. It is really difficult. And I'm going to tip my hat. These authors did a phenomenal job, 2,400 patients, multi-center trial. This is really, really hard research. And just because there is funding or that you have conflicts of interest doesn't negate what you found. All I'm looking for is transparency because we know that biases can creep in and conflicts of interest is just one of those potential biases to be considered. But it's certainly not an ad hominem attack at any of the authors in this study. Okay, let's run through the results. They randomized close to 2,400 patients with a median age. Oh my goodness. Almost my age. 60 years. Oh, wah, wah. Okay, yeah. So median age was 60 years, 42% for female. And you mentioned earlier, more than half of them, 56%, were intubated in the emergency department. Nearly half had sepsis or septic shock, and the median Apache 2 score was 18, with about 22%, so 1 in 4 to 1 in 5, were receiving vasopressors the hour before intubation. These were sick people. Scott, what was the key result?
For critically ill adults undergoing emergency tracheal intubation in the ED or ICU, ketamine and etomidate produced similar 28-day in-hospital mortality, but ketamine was associated with more cardiovascular collapse by that composite outcome and hypotension around the time of intubation.
All right, let's put some numbers on that primary outcome. This was in-hospital death by a month. In 28 days, how many people had died in both groups?
So ketamine, 28.1% versus etomidate at 29.1%.
And when you run the statistics, that's less than a 1% difference with a fairly tight 95% confidence interval around the point of no difference. Now, there were a number of secondary outcomes, and I'll put a table in the show notes. But Scott, are there any of the secondary outcomes you want to pull out and highlight from this?
So Ken, your table nicely describes the secondary outcomes of relevance. There's one more that isn't on there that people should be aware of because, and as we'll discuss later on, people look at this composite endpoint and they're like, well, there was no difference in cardiac arrest. There was no difference in systolic blood pressure less than 65. All that matters is the vasopressors. This isn't a real signal. It doesn't matter. There is one more. They actually looked at systolic blood pressures less than 80, which is still, in my mind, a relevant number. And then that was a clear difference between ketamine and etomidate as well. So that's the only other one I'd really have in mind when we talk about this.
This is why I need a second set of eyes. It's not just my interpretation. I love having a guest skeptic on it because you might pull out something that you think is really important that I missed. And so that systolic blood pressure less than 80. Now, would you agree traditionally in emergency medicine, we consider hypotension less than 90 millimeters of mercury or a MAP less than 65. And that's just a general statement for a definition. Obviously, it takes place in a context.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So that systolic less than 80 is clearly in the definition of hypotension. And when people look at that systolic of less than 65, they might be conflating that with a MAP. They use a number that is very scary. A systolic less than 65, no one could argue that is a scary, scary number. And there wasn't a difference between the two groups. You almost could say, well, if they had included a more ED standard number, like a MAP of less than 65, that probably would have been clinically significant in their composite outcome.
It's interesting that you pulled that out because when I was reading it, my first pass read was, oh, MAP less than 65. And it took a second read to really click in that in their composite outcome, it was a systolic blood pressure of less than 65. So many of us can be tripped up on those types of things. But I brought you on for lots of reasons, but one of my favorite reasons to have guest skeptics on is because I get to talk nerdy and we get to talk about things that we think are relevant that threaten the validity of the study. And I like to get different perspectives. So Weingart, are you ready to talk nerdy to Milne?
I love talking nerdy about RSI. Let's do it.
Okay, so the first thing, and you already mentioned this was an open label study. And an open label trial, neither the clinicians nor the research staff were masked to the assignment. And so this lack of blinding can bias both the co-intervention, so this is performance bias, and it can also bias the outcome measure, and that's called detection bias, especially for outcomes that rely on some clinical judgment. Now, their primary outcome, that death by day 28, may not be impacted so much by this, but their key secondary outcomes like cardiovascular collapse is partially defined by starting or escalating a vasopressor, which is inherently a clinical decision. And if I know, like as the clinician, and I believe, oh, well, you know, ketamine, it's pretty neutral. It's not going to tank their blood pressure. It was safer, more pressure friendly. I've got that bias in my head. I might delay starting a vasopressor because, yeah, no, this is going to work out. But if I pulled the trigger on etomidate, I might treat the etomidate patient more, oh, geez, we better worry about this. Oh, boy, we're going to tank their blood pressure, you know, aggressively with prophylactic pressures, biasing the composite in the other direction. And so because group assignments was known and the threshold for vasopressor adjustments wasn't standardized or masked, we can't be entirely sure how much of the difference in the collapse that was reported reflects true actual hemodynamic physiology versus some clinical behavioral psychology influenced by expectations.
100%. And if I had to make any commentary about this trial, because this trial was amazingly well wrought, I am just so impressed with what the pragmatic critical care group is doing. This is an amazing trial. If they had come to me beforehand, and you know, I wish more researchers would go seek out outside people to talk to about their protocols before they do it rather than hearing from us afterwards. But I would have said, just blind it. Now, the reason they didn't blind the trial is because the doses they chose didn't match up for easy ability to just give a 10cc syringe to the participants and say, hey, you could either give half of this, you could give three quarters of this, or you could give the whole thing. Because the dose ranges of 0.2 to 0.3 of etomidate, the way they are mixed, do not precisely match up with ketamine. But I think they chose the wrong doses, as we'll discuss shortly, and they could have easily gone with 10 cc's of ketamine, you could reduce it to 5 cc's. 10 cc's of etomidate, you could reduce it to 5 cc's if needed. And they could have blinded this trial, I think, very easily if they had gone with slightly different doses. And that would have changed the interpretation dramatically, because then they wouldn't know which group the patient's in, just as you said, Ken. So I look at this as a missed opportunity. Blinding this would have been extraordinary.
Yeah, I wonder if they could have done something with the syringe itself. So externally, the syringe was the same appearance and size, but the different concentrations and stuff, they had a second syringe or like a double-walled sort of thing. So you felt you had a 10cc syringe in your hand regardless, and the one gave the one drug and the one gave the other drug, but it had a separate sleeve in there so that it would give the correct concentration even when you're interpreting that 10C. I'm not an engineer, but I think something could have been done there. But that's more complicated. And like you said, tip of the hat again to these researchers. They did a really, really good job.
All right. Well, if we're going to talk nerdy, we should talk about their composite secondary endpoint. So the key secondary outcome, the cardiovascular collapse, was comprised of a systolic blood pressure less than 65, as we mentioned, new or increased vasopressor use, and cardiac arrest. So if you had any of those, then you met the composite outcome. Now, composite outcomes can be misleading when their components differ substantially in clinical importance and frequency. And this is true when the treatment effect is driven by the most frequent but less patient-oriented outcomes, the less poo-oriented outcomes. In this trial, most of the difference in cardiovascular collapse appears driven by the increased vasopressor use and moderate hypotension. While cardiac arrest, arguably the biggest poo, was rare and similar between groups, patients probably care far more about avoiding arrest or having substantial hypotension or death than about an extra push of norepinephrine. Now, although the composite difference is statistically significant, we can be somewhat skeptical of interpreting it as indicating that ketamine is clinically worse. But there are some little pieces that go into your determination of whether or not it's relevant. Now, the first thing is, as mentioned, they looked at other outcomes, the systolic less than 80, the incidence of ventricular tachycardia, a whole bunch of other ways of analyzing hypotension, and the association kept coming through, and it is just an association when we get to these secondary outcomes, that ketamine probably caused, in the dose range chosen in this study, more hypotension than etomidate. But in that last statement, Ken, there is a lot of work being done by the dose range in the trial. So let's talk about this, Ken, if you'll give me a space to talk even nerdier about three theories why this composite outcome and the other markers of hypotension came out on the ketamine side. Is that okay?
The floor is yours, my friend.
All right. So there's been three theories posited, and I'll tell you after which ones I agree with. The first one is it's a real signal that's being seen. And then we ask for some explanatory backup of why that theory would be the case. So if it is real, why would that be? Now, that negative inotropy you mentioned is still lingering out there. I looked into this pretty extensively. In fact, I have a paper ready to go to press that now I have to decide whether it's even worth publishing after the RSI trial about the my state of dubiousness as to whether this negative inotropic effect really exists in the dose ranges we use in emergency medicine, even in the dose ranges we use in the RSI trial. So maybe it's a tiny bit, but I don't really buy it. Second rationale for it being a real signal is that ketamine has an analgesic effect and Etomidate doesn't. You're just intubating with a sedative when you use Etomidate. So maybe the patients have a lot more endogenous catechols being spewed when you jam that laryngoscope in the back of their throat that you don't see with ketamine. So it's a real thing, but it might be a real thing that's beneficial because the patient has better analgesia. Many anesthesiologists use, if they're using Etomidate, fentanyl as well. And it might be that that would cause as much or even more hypotension than ketamine would when used in combination. Then the theories of it's not real. It's a marker of the lack of blinding we just discussed. So about 2% more patients were on vasopressors in the Etomidate group before they actually intubated. And 2% more patients in the Etomidate group got prophylactic vasopressors with induction. And a lot of people will point to that and saying they were treated differently. They were more likely to be on vasopressors and they were more likely to get prophylactic ones during the intubation. Now, in my mind, these numbers are pretty small, but maybe it contributed. The last one is this might be a real effect of ketamine, but we would never see this in our own clinical practice because they use too much. They use too much ketamine. And the dose ranges they used were not the dose ranges I use. And most of us in the United States, they're not what people are using. So they use 2 milligrams of ketamine. I can't remember the last time I did that, if I ever have, but it's certainly been 20 years. So 1.5 is usually my top dose. And I reduce all the way down to 0.5 when I am giving ketamine to a patient who is hemodynamically unstable. So in that case, this might be a real effect of just too much ketamine. So for all three of those reasons, this signal might exist. And my guess is it's a combination of all of them, might not be necessarily applicable to your clinical practice.
Well, I'm glad we gave you the floor for that because there's some really important stuff you pulled out there. I'll start at the last thing you said. I dial down my ketamine to 0.5. I can always add more. I don't start at 1 or 1.5 or 2. So I was surprised by the 2 dose, not so much by the 1. Fine, fair. 1.5, yeah, okay, I've used 1.5. I don't think I've gone up to 2. And so the dose maketh the poison, right? Every drug has potential benefits and potential harms, and there can be a dose response to the benefits and the harms. And so like you, and this is kind of neat, I use 0.5 when I have this really critically ill patient. They're fragile. Okay, let's take a breath. Let's give them 0.5. Are we good? Okay, no. Well, let's give them another 0.5. They're good? Let's intubate them. Done. Easy. And I just need the right amount to get the right intubation conditions to get the tube in the right place on the first attempt. And I'm using the least amount that requires that. And so that was the first point. And the other one is just more of a general point about post hoc rationalization. These are all hypotheses. That would be my friendly amendment. They're not theories, but they're hypotheses. We're hypothesizing about, why did this happen? Why did we observe what we did, what we saw? How can we explain these numbers? And we form some hypotheses around that. And then those hypotheses would need to be tested for us to accept that that was the correct conclusion. And so really a stimulating paper with these secondary outcomes and how to interpret them.
Absolutely.
Number 3, selection bias and exclusion criteria. We mentioned this when we were talking about the PCOT. The trial excluded several really important patient groups, trauma patients. They're critically ill. They need to be intubated. It'd be nice to know about them, but I understand why they, dichotomized into trauma patients, which might have muddied the waters or muddied the outcome because trauma patients are different than medically ill patients. The pregnant patients, I see a lot of emergency physicians, and I was talking to one recently. They're like, I don't like it when a patient who's pregnant comes in and they're pushing and it's, I'm going to have to deliver a crash delivery and stuff like that. But we need to know this so we know how to treat these patients well. And then crash intubations, no time for randomization. But this is the last one. This is the part that sort of got me the most. It was when the clinician believed ketamine or Etomidate was specifically indicated or contraindicated. So that is the selection bias right there. Now, they did conduct this in 6 U.S. academic centers when it came to the emergency departments. No community hospitals. So not where I work, not in a rural critical access hospital, not in the pre-hospital setting where our colleagues work so hard there. And so we need to reflect on whether the study patients differ significantly from ours and the results may not apply. Now, here the results, they may not generalize to a trauma patient. So you need to think about it. obstetrical patients, pre-hospital RSI, low-resource countries or community settings where, you know, the patients, the logistics, the operator experience, we can't all be Weingarts. We can't all have skills like you, Scott, right? Some of us are struggling and may not see these many patients in the rural setting. So in addition, allowing clinicians to exclude patients whenever they had this strong preference for one agent means that potentially the sickest or most fragile patients, the ones that we're worried about most, may have been preferentially excluded from the trial because they're the ones on the edge. And which way are we going to nudge them? So this type of discretion in the enrollment is a form of selection bias. That's the technical term for that. And it's a threat to both the internal validity and the external validity of the trial. And so if you saw consecutive enrollment without any subjective exclusion of patients, you just got randomized, that can mitigate against this type of bias.
Yeah, absolutely. Though the trial authors did an amazing job of mitigating a bunch of this. So they did what I love in a pragmatic trial is when these patients were excluded prior, they still looked at them and gave you explanations for why. So if you look in the supplement, there is very meticulous detail on these patients who were excluded. And when you look into it, it's a small number. And I don't think they biased the results because the rationale was the same. Like I used ketamine for this reason. And then the next person did etomidate for the exact same reason. So I feel better about this than a lot of pragmatic trials where you have no idea what happened to the excluded patients. Now, the trauma is interesting. The reason they didn't include trauma patients was they were worried that ketamine would spike the blood pressure. And many trauma patients might have traumatic brain injury at the same time, and they were worried about that. One of the nice things that came out of this trial was that ketamine does not spike the blood pressure. This is the largest cohort looking at this. And we were always worried they'll have this huge sympathetic surge and it just doesn't happen. So I feel much more comfortable after this trial using ketamine on patients who spike in blood pressure will be a problem, knowing it's not going to do very much more than etomidate would.
Yeah, choices have limitations, right? And so I appreciate that there's ethical concerns around, oh, well, if I ethically think that this is the best for this patient, then how can we possibly randomize them? And when those sort of conversations come up, they're difficult and challenging. And it's just a way that we need to know how to interpret the literature and apply the literature based on the limitations, the choices that were made. And it's not a pointing a finger at the choice that was made. It was a rational choice, but it has outcomes that we need to consider in the process.
Absolutely. So let's go to number four, non-protocolized co-interventions and performance bias. So this circles back to the trial being open label. Apart from specifying the induction drug and its dose range, the protocol left all other aspects of care, choice and dose of neuromuscular blockers, timing and amount of fluid boluses, use and titration of vasopressors, steroid administration, and ventilator management entirely to the clinician's discretion. In an open label trial, this introduces the potential for performance bias. Clinicians might manage ketamine and etomidate patients differently because of pre-existing beliefs about those drugs. For example, they may be more likely to give preemptive vasopressors before etomidate because of fear of adrenal suppression, or they might push higher doses of ketamine in sicker-looking patients. Unequal co-interventions threaten the assumption that only the randomized treatment, ketamine or etomidate, differs between the groups. This suggests that some observed hemodynamic differences, for example, greater vasopressor escalation with ketamine, may partly reflect management style rather than pharmacology alone.
That was good spaced repetition, right? Really hammer that home about that fact. So the fifth and final, the power. You don't know the power of the dark side. Yes, that's a reference back to the beginning of the show with the Star Wars. Anyways, this trial was powered to detect a relatively large absolute difference in mortality, like 5%. I struggled when I saw that and thought, what do we do in critical care that has a 5% absolute difference between groups? One of the quick ones I came up with is if somebody comes in with a heart attack, the number needed to treat with aspirin, okay? So a simple intervention that we've known for a long time is 42. So that is like not 5% mortality benefit, right? And so they powered the study. They said we need about 2,400 patients to show a 5% absolute mortality benefit. And the observed risk difference at 28-day mortality was less than 1%. And the confidence interval is reasonably tight around that point estimate. But if you look at it on the plus minus side, you're still talking somewhere around 3 to 4% absolute difference in mortality in either direction. And 3 to 4% difference, some clinicians, me included, would consider that clinically relevant. If I could save 1 in 30 patients with just what did I pick to do the induction agent, that has importance to me and certainly importance to the patient. Also, the study wasn't primarily powered for these subgroup analyses, the patients in septic shock or on vasopressors. And so multiple subgroup comparisons are presented, but these should be hypothesis generating because these subgroup analyses are clearly underpowered and at risk of spurious findings unless pre-specified and strongly biologically plausible. So consider them hypothesis generating, not practice changing. And so while the overall result strongly suggests no mortality difference, modest benefits or harms in a particular subgroup, we really can't exclude it. So we can't say it doesn't matter. We just can't say it does matter. And that's that little nuance that a lot of people miss.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, we've talked for about 45 minutes, so let's get down to a bottom line.
So for critically ill adults being intubated in the ED or ICU, there is no high-quality evidence from this trial to choose ketamine over etomidate to improve survival. And etomidate does not appear to carry an increased mortality.
Let's circle back to the case you presented at the very beginning, this 62-year-old woman with septic shock who was critically ill, who you needed to take away and provide them with a definitive emergent airway.
All right. So based on this trial, you could say that choosing ketamine instead of etomidate is very unlikely to change her chance of being alive in the hospital at day 28. But ketamine may give her a higher risk of BP dropping and needing more vasopressors during and immediately after the tube goes in. Etomidate does transiently suppress cortisol, but in this large randomized controlled trial, it did not translate into higher mortality, even in the many patients with sepsis. For this patient, already on norepinephrine with a MAP that is too low for comfort, a reasonable choice would be an RSI using etomidate at a reduced dose combined with preemptive hemodynamic optimization, fluids as appropriate, vasopressor uptitration, and if you use them, a small dose of push-dose pressors during induction. If you or your team are more experienced with ketamine RSI, it's also reasonable to use ketamine with an honest expectation that you may need aggressive vasopressor support and close BP monitoring. The third, and in my humble opinion, the best option, is a ketamine delayed sequence intubation, a DSI. Either way, you would optimize preload and vasopressor support before induction, use a paralytic you're comfortable with, plus meticulous pre-oxygenation and anticipate hypotension, have vasopressor boluses or infusions ready to go.
All right. So we've talked about this really important trial, I think, from many standpoints. How are you going to apply it where you work?
So clinical applications for mortality. This trial makes it very unlikely that one of these agents confers a substantial mortality advantage over the other in a general ED or ICU setting when dealing with a critically ill population. Your choice of induction agent should not be driven by fear that etomidate kills people via the adrenal suppression we know it causes, or that ketamine is magically protective.
And so the EBM answer is, it all depends on the clinical situation. There's the hemodynamics to consider, and in this trial, ketamine was associated with more peri-intubation hypotension and greater vasopressor escalation than etomidate. Don't assume that ketamine is always this hemodynamically safe, smooth option in catecholamine depleted shock. You still need to aggressively resuscitate and support these patients' blood pressure.
Absolutely. In terms of patient and context factors, etomidate may be preferable as a default for RSI for patients in profound shock where hypotension is a primary concern and adrenal suppression is less concerning in light of this RCT. Ketamine might still be preferred in patients where you want bronchodilation or where etomidate is contraindicated.
And from a local practice standpoint, because we work in different environments, the evidence should be integrated with clinical experience and local resources. If your team is more comfortable and faster and more successful with one agent, I would go with that agent. And that might be completely reasonable to influence your choice, as long as you understand there's a trade-off in there and you've got to be prepared for the other side of things.
Absolutely. This is not a one-size-fits-all situation. This trial covers ED and ICU adults, not trauma, not pregnancy, not the pre-hospital environment, not pediatrics. For those populations, we must still extrapolate cautiously from other data.
All right, so you're standing at the bedside. You've got this critically ill patient. You're going to be talking to the family. What do you tell them?
That we need to give a medication to put her to sleep quickly and safely so we could place a breathing tube. There are two main medicines we use for this. We're going to choose the drug that we think best fits her situation and at the same time support her blood pressure with fluids and medications. We'll be right at the bedside watching her closely the entire time.
I find talking to patients and patients' families and thinking out loud with regards to various choices actually makes them have more confidence in what you're doing. Because it's not just that you're following a recipe, a cookbook, a checklist. At times, you're actually thinking about their loved one. You're thinking, okay, should I choose this, but it might do that? Should I choose that? And then you come to some kind of resolution. But when you're thinking out loud, you're showing them that you're invested in them getting the best care possible based on your clinical experience and interpretation of the literature. And I find that the patients and their families have much more confidence in you and understanding when things happen a certain way because they heard you talk out loud and ruminate out loud about, what should we do for you? You specifically, the N of one, the VIP, the very important patient I'm treating right now.
Could not agree more.
All right, time for the Keener contest. And last week's winner was all the way from New Zealand, a 2026 first winner of the year, Dr. Stephen Steltz, no surprise. Maybe it's because he's in New Zealand he always wins because he's from the future, right? They're like hours and hours and hours ahead. So he gets this podcast, even though I posted at the same time. He wins a lot, but it could be because Stephen is from the future. He knew that a sphygmomanometer or a blood pressure cuff is generally credited to Dr. River Rocci, an Italian physician who invented it in 1896. Scott, what's the question this week?
The question this week, which enzyme in the adrenal steroidogenesis pathway is primarily inhibited by etomidate, thereby decreasing cortisol synthesis?
Oh, I'm asking people to go back to their organic chemistry lectures with all, I called them chicken wires. I grew up on a farm. So all those little steroid rings and all those things look like chicken wire to me. But if you know the answer, then you send me an email to thesgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a big shout out on the next show. Well, I couldn't have picked a better guest to celebrate 500 episodes of SGEM Critical Appraisals than you, my friend, Scott Weingart.
What a pleasure, and congratulations again, Ken.
And I'm looking forward to seeing you at Incrementum. That's in April 2026, Murcia, Spain. Please go to the website, click on the link, sign up. It is going to be the best conference you go to in 2026.
Damn straight.
All right, Scott, can you do the SGEM tagline, but really lean into that Weingart voice that we're all in love with?
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.